Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View. I'm your not-so-humble host, PK, for Monday evening, October 10th, and I'm on BBS Radio Station 2. Again, I'd like to always thank our hosts here at BBS Radio for promoting free speech and through their alternative media so we can contact a lot more people, because the mainstream corporate Zionist media likes to exclude, likes to have their opinion cartel and tweak the news with their buddies in the CIA and FBI and the whole security apparatus, of which I am not a part of. I can't be bought, can't be sold, can't be bullied by political correctness or otherwise. So anyway, I have an interesting guest tonight. She's been on here before. And I'm having her back again because we're going to be talking about the Middle East, and which is a topic that I talk about a lot. As you know, if you've listened before, I'm very critical of Israel and Zionism, and I slam on both of them. Of course, I reject the usual cowardly term or accusations of anti-Semitism or anti-Semite or racist or racism, because mine is always an expose on power. It's not linked to kill these people or harm those other people. That's not it at all. So, and this is a topic that needs to be discussed because it affects our country so greatly with the wars and whatnot. And of late, we have the Occupy Wall Street crowd, which is not only in Wall Street, but is forming up in other cities. And they lack direction and a clear focus and a clear purpose. Well, I, of course, volunteer to lead them if they need a great intellectual leader. Here I am. And if where the two circles cross, I'm in strict agreement with them about some very narrowly defined things that I see that are a major problem that I always rail against. And the Tea Party probably agrees with me, too, on these. In fact, the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street crowd, where the circle crosses, we probably agree on the final these things that I'm going to delineate, as I always do. And I always rail against the perversion of free market capitalism. I am totally against crony capitalism, corporate welfare, bailouts, protectionism, subsidies, and political privilege for the politically connected. Those aspects I'm in agreement with Occupy Wall Street with, and also the wars are bankrupting our country tremendously. It's such a waste of blood and treasure. And fortunately, even conservatives are coming around to realizing that Vietnamistan, otherwise known as Afghanistan, is, it's 10 years. I mean, when are we ever going to declare victory and leave? So with that, I'm going to invite, and hopefully she's out there, I'm welcoming back Allison Weir from If Americans Knew. Allison, are you out there? Probably not, because I didn't set the number yet. Anyway, I'm taking care of that number situation. But Allison is with If Americans Knew, and it is I would call it an educational organization that informs people as to where their tax dollars are going into the Middle East and what is going on with Israel and how it's being constantly supported by the U.S. to the tune of, I believe it's $7 million a day. Israel gets more foreign aid from the U.S. than any other foreign country. Now, if you combine the other ones together, yes, there's more, including the Arab countries. And it's always been my position, not only that there should be no foreign aid, no tax-funded foreign aid, but I would especially cut Israel off first. And I'd also have probably an arms embargo against Israel and most countries, because all these arms that we sell are coming back to haunt us. And it's not, I don't see it really being that free market, because they're subsidized through defense contractors, defense spending, who knows? But these weapons then come back to face our troops. So once again, the libertarian policy of helping other people is, if Americans want to help people in other countries or charities or what have you, they are free and encouraged to write a check or make it to the donation of the country or the cause of their choice. But they can't force others to give foreign aid. And another thing about foreign aid is, especially in like agriculture, well, if you're giving, I know we want to help people or starving people or whatnot, but if you constantly give food to foreign countries, that depresses farm prices for the local farmers. So that's a problem. Let me ask the suits something for a minute, ladies and gentlemen. All right, is my guest out there, my friends? Oh, great ones in the office. Is our guest with us? Huh. We seem to be incommunicado. Well, I've had... Hello there. Is our guest with us?
Yes, this is Allison.
Allison, welcome back to Third Stream View.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
You're looking good.
Would you care for... Yes, same to you.
Well, I know that. Would you care for some tea or coffee?
I could use some coffee. Sounds great.
Well, it's self-service, sorry. But let me tell you, not only welcome back, but I've been, I don't know if you got my email earlier today, I was reading from your site, If Americans Knew, your essay for September 2011 of the, what's the exact title? The American-Israel History of How We Go Back. I'm sorry,
yes,
I forget.
History of Israel-U.S. Relations.
Yes, and I got to tell you, it was I enjoyed reading it. It was very informative. I already was hip to a lot of it, but you filled in some more. So you've been doing some serious research, or historical discoveries and findings on this.
Yeah, it was. It's pretty astounding. I've been reading many, many books on this topic for the past 10 years, and finally decided I'd been meaning for a long time to try to write really more of the history about the period leading up to about 1950, and set out to write what I hoped would be a sort of synopsis of it. But there was so much that I just felt was necessary for people to know that it's ended up being, if you print it out, including all the footnotes, it's around 45 pages, I think. And, of course, that's not everything, but at least that's more of a thorough presentation about what happened during those years than I've seen many places, really.
It was excellent.
Except for some of these excellent books.
Yeah. I was wondering, because I'll always try to give myself a pat on the back. I wonder if you recall the last time we spoke a few months ago, if our conversation inspired you at all, or did you already know a lot of the things that I had mentioned to you about the history of Zionism and this, you know, especially in the last 100 years or so?
Oh, I probably knew it all about 5 years ago.
Oh, good for you.
After I'd read a lot of these books. because I started reading these books in about the year 2000 and read many of them just in those first probably 3 or 4 years. So what happened is I've added to it. I've ordered more and more books from the footnotes of some of those books. So I've added to it, but most of this I had known really by 2005 and have been meaning ever since to write an article. I've written some articles that contain a little bit of it. There was one article I wrote a few years, just about it, maybe 2 years ago, about Tom Campbell, where I tell a little bit about it. But I kept meaning to write really about the U.S.-Israel relations and about the number of all these State Department officials that opposed it for years and years, decades. That was exposed especially by Donald Neff, who's written 5 books about Israel-Palestine, by Kathleen Christensen, who's written 2 books, by George Ball, who wrote an excellent book about it, by Stephen Green, who wrote 2 excellent books that were published about 20 years ago. John Mulhall wrote a book that was published also about 20 years ago. Alfred Lilienthal. There are just these excellent books that I stumbled upon. Most of them are out of print. Very few of them are still in print. But because of Amazon, you can order them, and often they're not hugely expensive. Some of them are not even available on Amazon, but now and then I'm in Washington, D.C., and you can get them often at the Library of Congress. So I did that research quite a while ago, and then finally just wrote this piece several months ago.
Well, I'm sure that some of the authors that you've read were also anti-Zionist Jewish authors.
Some of them were, yes. Alfred Lilienthal was. He was a member of the one of the really the most prominent anti-Zionist Jewish organization back before the UN partition resolution was even being discussed. So there was this a strong stream of anti-Zionist Jews back in the for many years. But he was mainly active starting in about the 40s. So his book and another one by Rabbi Elmer Berger are also very useful. Most of the other authors I mentioned are not Jewish or Palestinian or Arab or ideological. They're just, in some cases, journalists or historians without a particular ethnic tie to either party who just, for various reasons, did these excellent research jobs and discovered much of the many of the facts. Some of the best articles are by former diplomats who were stationed in the Middle East back in the 30s and 40s and who later wrote their memoirs or different articles or in some cases their oral histories that are available at the Truman Library. So I'd say, you know, the authors that come from diverse backgrounds.
Well, I'd sure like to thank you again for bringing a lot of that to the forefront. I first learned about this about 6 years ago, and I started writing a few essays about 2002 and 2003 because you might recall that I had said that after 9/11, when everybody was out demonizing, not everybody, but so many were out demonizing Muslims and Islam, I went the other way, and I studied the other tribe. I was studying the Jewish history, and I, you know, I was uncovering more that, and I didn't like a lot of what I was reading and finding, and it had nothing to do with stereotypical, the typical stereotypical type things, and everything I read, and like what you read and what you write, Allison, it's not, and I always make this point because I'm much more blunt than most, and certainly I don't think you're blunt. You're quite a nice lady, but I'm blunt, and I tell it like it is. But it's never connected to advocating hatred, oppression, violence, depriving anybody of their rights. When I read you, when I read these other authors who are critical of Israel and Zionism, my point is it's never connected to hurting anybody or advocating violence. Or, you know, it's always an expose on history.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think you're right. That sort of differentiates those writing on the two from different perspectives on this, because certainly these authors I've mentioned, as I say, most of these authors were just historians or journalists writing the facts. Some had a specific advocacy position. For example, Lilienthal, when he was working at the UN advocating for policies of justice, fairness, and self-determination of peoples. I think those are principles most of us believe in. But almost no one from this side calls for violence or warfare. Whereas you have somebody like Dershowitz, who is a Harvard professor, allegedly, you know, the left for a long time considered him a progressive, liberal of sorts, somebody on the side of civil liberties and, you know, against oppression. And here we have Dershowitz, who calls for things like destroying an entire village in Palestine. That's collective punishment. That's what the Nazis did, and that's what the Geneva Accords now say are illegal and are war crimes. In fact, that would be a crime against humanity legally. And yet Dershowitz, who is allegedly a legal scholar at Harvard, calls for that. He's in favor of torture. So his writings are really quite violent. And yet, you know, to the mainstream, apparently he's considered normal.
Well, he's awful. And as you know, he helped deprive anti-Zionist Jew Norman Finkelstein of his tenure at DePaul in Chicago.
That's right. He advocated firmly against that. He was embarrassed by Finkelstein because Dershowitz had allegedly written a book. Clearly he does, you know, it's likely that he has graduate students who do a lot of the work, and some of them are maybe lazy or sloppy, and Dershowitz himself was probably even lazier and sloppier because he didn't catch some of what they had done, which was lift passages out of a book previously published by a woman named Joan Peters, a hoax in which she claims that there were really no Palestinians, that there were just a few wandering Arabs, and when the wonderful entrepreneurial Zionists moved to the area, then these wandering Arabs came in to get the jobs that the lovely, generous Zionists were providing for them, and that allegedly that was the beginning of the Palestinian population. You know, it's absurd. It is truly absurd. In Israel, nobody took the book seriously, but in this country, a number of people all over the country gave it glowing reviews, most of them, of course, Zionists. Barbara Tuchman, who was a popular historian, gave it a glowing review. Saul Bellow, book reviewers for the New York Times, for the Atlantic, etc., all over the place reviewed it positively. Then Finkelstein was someone who actually went and looked at what she claimed were footnotes, looked back at the primary sources, found out she had either made up the footnote or she'd taken it from a propaganda tract or she had incorrectly cited it. You know, he exposed it for the fraud that it was. And yet you have Dershowitz about, I guess, a few decades later, writing a book where he was quoting from Joan Peters. But he didn't cite Joan Peters for it. He cited the primary source as though he had actually done the research to go to the primary source. But Finkelstein exposed the fact that he had not done so because he would show that in Dershowitz's version, supposedly from the primary source, there would be ellipses where certain phrases, or in some cases whole pages, would be left out in a fraudulent kind of quoting, in exactly, by coincidence, the same place that Joan Peters had done it. So he exposed that not only had Finkelstein plagiarized, because you're supposed to cite where you got your material, not where they got it, so he plagiarized her work without attributing it to her. Worse yet, her work was fraudulent. You know, it's just insane that he retained his position at a major institution of higher learning with that kind of track record. So I think the fact that Finkelstein exposed that made Dershowitz so angry that he brought pressure on DePaul, and they caved to the pressure and didn't give Finkelstein tenure.
You sound like you've seen Dershowitz's lame-ass debate with Finkelstein on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!
I've read the transcript. I didn't see or hear it in person, unfortunately. It's kind of funny to watch
because Finkelstein really just tears him a new one. He's so well informed. He's a true intellectual. He's a professor. He's an intellectual. You know, Dershowitz is some hotshot lawyer, you know, and I have a big problem with lawyers in general anyway, because they've over litigated our whole society. They gave us the drug war. You know, probably half the politicians are lawyers. Romney's a lawyer. Clinton's, you know, Obama's, both Clinton's. I believe Perry's a lawyer. Bachman's a lawyer. So, you know, that's another issue, but they have seriously overregulated our whole society. So, yeah, I understood exactly where you were coming from on this Dershowitz versus Finkelstein thing, because I watched the debate and it was kind of comical. Maybe you'll get to see it sometime. At this point, I'd like to also mention that we'll take any calls if anybody happens to call in. The number is 888-429-5471. That's 888-429-5471, in case anybody cares to call in. I think it's great that you're going down the path you're going down. You know, my grandfather, who was a very successful businessman, told me something probably 4 years ago, because he had a Jewish partner at one time. And I would never deny that the brilliance of a lot of Jewish, achievements and all that sort of stuff, from the arts to music to business, all those sort of things. But I don't believe it's because they're supposedly the chosen people. I believe it's what my grandfather told me 40 years ago. He said, "Why? You know, do you know why Jews are so successful?" He said, "Because they believe in strongly in education, family structure, career, and self-employment." And it would seem to me that any individual or group of people who goes down that path is going to be successful. I mean, Asian people are quite successful. And in fact, as a child, I was always taught to respect Asian people. You know, look, PK, look how hard they work, and they study hard too, you know. So I always had that instilled into me. That is what he told me is their success story. And they, I guess they like to say it because they think of themselves as the chosen people. And what I've tried to figure out is over the centuries, why did they face what they faced? Oppression or hatred. You'd read it in history books and stuff, but it never detailed why. Well, I've tried to understand why this is happening. I mean, there had to be a reason, because every country has wealthy, successful people, but they weren't necessarily all kicked out or, you know, kicked out en masse. And a lot of it goes back to the unethical, anti-Gentile, awful, racist things that come from the Talmud. I don't know if you've delved into it very deeply, the Jewish Book of Law, but it's got some awful things in it. And this, I believe, is where this comes from. Now, centuries ago in Europe, there were some massive book burnings of the Talmud, but not the Old Testament. I don't know if you knew that.
I think so. What I've done is I haven't read the Talmud myself. As I'm sure you know, it's 25 volumes.
There's a lot to it, yeah.
I'm sure it would be fascinating, but I haven't had the time to attempt that. What I have done is read a few books on it, and I think the best one I've found is not all that long. It's by an Israeli professor, Israel Shahak. You've probably read him. He wrote one book in particular called Jewish History, Jewish Religion.
I know of him, and I've read some of his essays. I'm a fan.
Yeah, he was excellent. Unfortunately, he died a few years ago, but he was an Israeli professor. He was a survivor, I believe, of Auschwitz. When he went to Israel as a young man, he was quickly outraged at the treatment he saw being perpetrated against Palestinians, and became very anti-Zionist, very critical of the Israeli government, wrote consistently about it apparently throughout the years, although his primary job was as a professor of chemistry. So in that book and in another book, Jewish Fundamentalism in Israel, he does quote quite a few important passages from the Talmud, and they certainly do show a great deal of animosity toward non-Jews, and a great deal of supremacy. Very similar,
right.
It's very similar to the types of things that the Nazis were written. Perhaps
there's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot of similarity. There's a lot of similarity.
There is. I think the amount of supremacist writings in some of the Jewish scriptures is important to know, and very few of us know that. I certainly had no idea of that before.
But
and it's not, as I've written, when I've written on this topic, I've always emphasized, it's not that that represents the majority of Jewish Americans or the majority of Jewish Israelis, but it does represent the beliefs of quite a few, especially in Israel, where that segment is disproportionately represented in the government. So it's very significant to learn what some of those beliefs are. And then I do think that it impacts, to a degree, cultural thinking in a wider sphere as well. I think it's relevant to be aware of, and yet that's probably one of the most covered-up parts about the Israeli-Palestinian issue, I think, that I found.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. And this supremacism thing, I've been looking at the Holocaust too. I've been studying that a bit, and I, you know I would be called a Holocaust denier. But here's the thing: I readily acknowledge that millions of people died. There was genocide. There was torture. There was execution. There was forced marches. There was forced labor. There was genocide. There was murder. There was concentration camps. There were gulags. I don't know what I've left out, but I readily acknowledge all of that. However, there are also reasons why Germany reacted like it did, and Europe felt like it did. And this is what I did not know. And Solzhenitsyn spoke about this too. And actually, Father Coughlin, I think, spoke about this too. I recently read a book by his defenders. And that is that the we may have mentioned this before, but the major architects of Lenin's Marxist revolution, and then Stalin's main henchmen and overseers of the gulags, they were atheist Russian Jews. They were the most numerous of the commissars, the radicals, the leaders, and these Marxist groups. And this led to the reaction of Europe. A lot of Europeans, they did not care for Hitler, but they saw Germany as the only thing standing in the way of Stalin and communism, because there was a massive communist effort to overthrow the Weimar Republic in Germany after World War I. There was massive Jewish-influenced communist takeover, as there were in Franco's Spain, the opposition, who killed a lot of the clergy and this and that. They were there was a lot of atheist Russian Jews from Russia involved in all this, as there were in the Marxist attempt to take over of Germany in the 20s. So I never knew that, but there's reasons. This is the sort of thing. Now, if this is hatred, well, I totally reject those claims, but this is what I've learned and studied about it. And I don't know if you were hip to that, but and Solzhenitsyn talks about it too. So that this is where a lot of this came from. And these same atheist Russian Jews oversaw the murder of 20 million Christians. Also, they were the architects of the genocide. I can't pronounce the word exactly right. Holodomor in the Ukraine, which is why when German troops initially came into the Ukraine, they were welcomed as liberators to protect the people from Stalin. And come to find out, there were also Finns, Poles, anti-communist Russians, some Danes, some Swedes, Spaniards, Italians, and other Europeans who fought with Germany against Russia, against Stalin in World War II. I never knew that. So again, I take revisionism very important because it fills in a lot of things that we weren't told about. You know, I always heard, well, Germany invaded Poland. You know, well, why was that? I never knew why. I just, Hitler was the bad guy. Well, there, you know, even FDR, whom I despise, said that things happen for a reason. You know, I don't know if you're hip to some of this, but this is what I've learned over the last few years.
Yeah, there's a lot that we haven't, that are not taught in our history classes or in our history books. It's a much more complicated situation than the narrative that we're presented gives us. And it's extremely important that we learn the complexities of what led to World War II and the different aspects of it that are left out. I began, you know, Solzhenitsyn, his most recent books, have not been translated into English. Here we have, you know, a Nobel laureate, one of whose books at least was always taught in every high school class in the country, I'm quite certain. And yet, when he began to write about the Jewish aspect of what went on in these gulags, suddenly his writings are no longer available to Americans. I find that unacceptable. The only thing I know about him in those terms are the few things that are translated into English. There's a book of his writings that has some excerpts from some of those books in English. The Jewish press is where I first learned about this, because I often read places like JTA and Ynet and the Forward, which are Jewish publications in the U.S., or at least available in the U.S., that write about Israel a lot. So I would go to those to learn more about what was going on in Israel. And there I would read these articles about Solzhenitsyn, recent book, writing about the fact that, as you just noted, the number of the secret police and the leaders responsible for these really terrible, massive deaths in the gulags in Siberia and what was done were quite often Jewish. There's a very large Jewish presence among them. And apparently what Solzhenitsyn wrote was he didn't blame all of that on Jews at all, because apparently that's not where all the blame rests. But what he said in his books, I believe, I wish I could actually read the books, was that they were, you know, the recent narrative is that Russians, like every other group, are supposedly all anti-Semitic. For no reason, we have Russians are bigots against Jews with no understanding why that would be. We're just supposed to believe, right. Well, Russians are just bad people. Germans are bad people. Americans now are bad people. As more and more people become critical of Israel, supposedly we're all anti-Semites, without looking at the full story, where there's almost always blame on numerous sides. So that's what Solzhenitsyn wrote about, that there was blame on the Jewish side as well as on the Russian side for the violence that occurred in many cases. And he filled in some of those blanks. And I think because he was filling in those blanks, now his books aren't translated. I hope somebody sometime will have the time to translate, to do an accurate scholarly translation of his books so that they're available to all of us as they should be.
Well, I've got good news for you. I think I have a source where they have been translated. I'll send you an email later on or tomorrow where you can get them. And one is about Russia and the Jews.
Which books are they?
I think the last two, I believe. One is about Russia and the Jews. He's got the date, the timeline. It's almost 200 years, something like that. But I have a source.
Yeah, I think the title was something like 200 Years of Living Together or something of that.
Yes.
Sort.
Yes. Yeah. Now, yeah, every race of people, I mean, now you're a Caucasian lady, I think. Caucasians have had plenty of criminals, and I'm a Caucasian in our race. There's plenty of black criminals. There's Asian criminals. Every race or group of people has criminals in their own midst. But there happen to be Jewish criminals, too, or Zionist criminals. And they also cause the suffering of a lot of other Jews. And a lot of Jews have been so browbeaten by oppression or Zionism that they just, I think, take the word for it of their leaders or whatnot, and they haven't delved that deeply themselves into what's going on or why is this going on. They think probably because they're Jewish, oh, I'm disliked, or I have this legacy of oppression. But when you dig deeper, you find out, you know, there's more reasoning to it, the whys and the hows and whos. And also, I forgot to mention, but I have spoken about it before, though, is that these atheist Russian Jews, you know, they destroyed or closed most of the churches during Stalin's reign. However, synagogues were hardly ever harmed. So that was their, you know, that was their, they were obviously, you know, probably sensitive to that because they came from a Jewish background, even though they're atheist Jews. Which brings us to something else I talk about, is that I would say that the majority of world Jewry is either purely secular and or agnostic and or atheistic. Zionism is very atheistic. You know, that's why I love this sentence I came up with. 1947, 1948, ever since then. God gave us this land, shouted the atheist Zionist Jews. Well, if you don't believe in God, how could God give you the land?
You know, there's a bit of a contradiction there.
Yeah,
It's true that a lot of the founders of political Zionism largely were not at all religious, that observant Jews for the most part at that time opposed Zionism.
True.
Now, of course, many, that's changed quite a bit, but it's, you know, there's so much to this that's not discussed sufficiently. I think
it's deep.
I more concentrate, you know, in my article, I don't write about any of these topics, but I do write about the relationship of Zionism to the U.S. entry into World War One. Again, something that was never taught in our in any of the history books I've seen.
No.
But the fact that Zionism was a factor in the U.S. entry into World War One. This was written about by Britain quite a bit. They felt that this was a significant factor in the U.S. joining the war on their side. And yet, none of us has ever heard that. It's not debated. It's not discussed. I think it would be an interesting, very important discussion among people, going back to the primary sources, about whether this was a minor factor, as perhaps it was, or whether it was a major factor, as Zionists bragged that it was. And as
it was major.
Believe,
it was
or whether
very major.
It was sort of medium. You know, there are a lot of factors in many things. So, you know, would we have joined the World War One without Zionism as part of it? I don't think so. I don't know. You know, I'm willing to have somebody convince me, but I'd like to have all the evidence brought forward instead of only the evidence that leaves that part of it out, which is usually the case.
I happen to be more of a student of World War One than World War Two. It's fascinating. World War One was, I mean, all wars are horrible, but it was horrific. I mean, it was, you know, the life in the trenches, that whole thing, it was awful. World War Two, as bad as it was, the fighting doesn't scare me like the way World War One scares me when you think of what that whole thing was about. And have you heard, are you hip to Benjamin Friedman? He has a great speech. You can hear it on YouTube, I think, from 1960.
Yes, I am.
Okay,
that's
so you know about him. And he did a very
nice. I not only know about him, I have a lot of his writings that aren't on the internet right now.
Well, good for you. You must be very proud of me to know about this.
There are only about two things on the internet that I know about. But it turns out he wrote a lot more, and I'm hoping to write an article about that at some point.
Well, and he was also a very naughty man because he did something that Jews really dislike. He became a Christian, as I understand it.
He did. He converted.
And so did, you know this person, Mordecai Vanunu?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yes, Vanunu, for the listeners that don't, of course, fortunately, he's still alive, very much alive, but being held captive largely by Israel. He was the nuclear technician who blew the whistle on Israel's nuclear weapons program and then was imprisoned for about 18 years, 12 of those years in solitary confinement.
Awful.
And he did, as I think you were about to say, he converted to Christianity at some point. I'm not sure when that was.
Yeah. Well, I was I don't know if I mentioned this to you before. I mean, I survived 8 years of Catholic school, and Catholics make the best atheists. I'm a non-militant atheist. So that gives me a little cred here because I can navigate down because I know where they're coming from. But I would never close churches. I would never repress anybody's rights. I just want to be left alone. Atheists aren't the ones promoting all these wars and doing all this nonsense, bankrupting our country and whatnot. But I was wondering, Allison, like the conversation we're having this evening, do you have many of these with other people or friends? Do you have, obviously you know that I'm pretty well informed on this, which is, of course, why I enjoy speaking with you. Do you have many conversations with people that are aware like we're aware?
Well, That's an interesting question. Not very many. You know, I have interesting conversations with a lot of people that are very well informed on the Palestinian issue, the latest of it, the history in the region itself of the Nakba, the 1947-49 catastrophe. So I have a lot of people, not enough, but a lot of people know that very well, and are, you know, it's interesting to discuss those aspects with them. But not as many people really know the U.S. aspect. There are still quite a few people that try to deny the power of the Israel lobby, which is astounding, but there's still that attempt that goes on.
Right. What I told you before, what APAC
Very few people know about Benjamin Friedman, for example.
Thank you.
I don't think I've ever mentioned him in any of my writing so far because it hasn't specifically come up on a topic that I'm writing, although this recent article, he probably would have been relevant to cite, but I don't think that I did.
Well, again, I want you to consider me a friend and an ally and a supporter of where you're coming from because you are giving an intellectual take on things. I like to use that word intellectual. It's an intellectual take. It's your innocent expose on power, like I have mine's always an expose on power, regardless of who wields it or who yields it. And that's how I look at it. And as I speak, I have the great Jewish economist Ludwig von Mises above me, my photo in my office. And I donate to the Ludwig von Mises Institute, whose mentor was a Jewish intellectual. I'm a big fan of Murray Rothbard's and Ayn Rand's. So I do the talk and I do the walk, but I won't be intimidated by Zionism or, you know, frequently that word that's thrown around, anti-Semitism. What I would say is, oh, well, I much prefer the new definition of anti-Semitism, which is a person that Jews don't like.
By the way, Ayn Rand, I believe, was a Zionist.
she's leaned that way.
Because I used to...
She escaped Russia. Go ahead.
I couldn't hear what you said.
She escaped Russia. She didn't like what was going on. She left during the Communist Revolution, but she was pretty much anti-Palestinian. I saw her on the Donahue show go off on the Palestinians, you know. Now, the Palestinians would be successful or more successful if they, too, were backed by the Rothschilds. The Rothschilds who financed the Zionists and who, I think, bankrolled the Knesset building, their parliament. So they had this, you know, Zionist Rothschild backing when they, you know, took over Palestine.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, that gives you a little bit of an advantage, I'd say.
A hell of an advantage. And I believe that it's the Rockefeller Rothschild axis that controls the world right now is the power structure. Have you heard the expression in the past during post-World War I or maybe between World War I and World War II, have you ever heard that Hitler had said the Jews stabbed Germany in the back? Have you ever heard that terminology?
Yes, I have. Well, I've heard that type of thing from a number of directions. Heard that the Zionists stabbed the German Jews in the back. That's sort of a paraphrase of one quote that I have somewhere. Also, of course, that there was a boycott against Germany early on that caused it, you know, pretty may have caused or certainly played a role in the financial collapse, in which that became so bad that German families were in some cases facing starvation.
It was
children
a big
German children were starving to death during the time that we think of as the Great Depression. In the U.S. was far worse in Germany.
That played a big role in it, Allison. That was
played a role in that. So there's a lot there of importance.
Well, that happened on March 24th, 1933, when global Zionism international Jewry declared a war economic boycott against Germany. But this was opposed by most of the Jews within Germany. They didn't want that to happen. Mm-hmm. And on March 28th, we hear in the history books how the Germans boycotted Jewish shops and this and that. Well, it was a reaction against their boycott on March 24th, 1933. Getting back to this accusation, Hitler said that the Jews stabbed Germany in the back. I'll give you my take on it. Well, what he... To narrow it would have been Zionist Jews, the Jewish bankers, stabbed Germany in the back, and other Jews too, because, you know, they wanted Palestine. They wanted their own Jewish state, which they were pushing for, you know, before World War I, around the turn of the century. So, again, the biggest lie and myth is that Israel was not created as a result of World War II. It goes back to the, you know, World War I and what Theodor Herzl, atheist Jewish benefactor of Israel, like the patron saint of Israel, if you will, and what 1897 in Switzerland with their Jewish meeting of the Zionists that wanted to set up a Zionist state, and prior to even between 1800 and 1900, I don't know of any major genocides against Jews in Europe. Yes, there were pogroms in Russia, but I don't know of, you know, major anti-Semitism in Europe. But anyway, this Hitler stabbed Germany in the back thing, so I guess he knew ultimately that the German Jewish bankers and the Zionist Jews of Germany, those particular ones who did this, went to Britain and said, you know, we'll... You can still win this war, because in 1916, Germany was, you know, pretty much in charge. They were the winners. It should have been over with and done then, and it would have been an armistice, and things would have gone back to almost normal. But so they told the British, look, we'll bring America in. You can still win this. We'll bring America in, but you've got to give us Palestine, which was Turkey control, and Germany was in league with Turkey. So this is the treasonous reasons that Hitler said that the Jews stabbed Germany in the back. This is my take on it. This is how I now understand it. And Benjamin Friedman talks about this. So that's where I get this from.
Yeah, there's well, in the article that you mentioned, that one about Israel-U.S. relations, it does talk about that period of I think what you were just talking about of getting that the U.S. to join.
Right.
The World War One, in, as you said, in 1916, Germany had largely won the war, and therefore the British were desperate for American help, and of course, you know, so this is how they pushed the U.S. into entering the war. At least that's how they thought, that they would be able to get the U.S. to enter the war. They sent a memo to Brandeis, who was a Supreme Court justice, who was a close friend of Woodrow Wilson. And, you know, there's more detail in my article itself. And, of course, you know, then Germany was defeated with the help of the U.S. There were flyers that were dropped on Germany telling, basically, talking about the Jewish role, even though it was really the Zionist role, but the flyers were talking about the Jewish role in getting the U.S. to join, to fight against Germany. You know, so it made Jews in Germany seem like they were part of this international conspiracy against Germany.
Right.
What Zionists in particular have always done is they always portray themselves as representing all Jews.
Right.
They don't do that. They didn't then. They certainly weren't representing all German Jews or all American Jews or all Palestinian Jews, but that's what they claim to do. And so it will appear that way to others, naturally. If somebody says, we are the Jews and this is what we're doing, then other people will attribute blame to, quote, Jews rather to the Zionist ideology that is actually perpetrating these different actions. And that's what went on there.
They've hijacked the Jewish religion, and they've also tried to do today, and I laugh at this, they try to equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism.
That's right.
They're not the same thing.
You know, they're not, and any criticism of Israel becomes, quote, anti-Semitic, because that has in the last 10 years, that started to wear off a little bit. People begin to roll their eyes when they hear, you know, somebody being critical of Israel, being called anti-Semitic. So that's, they're having to retreat on that a little bit, at least in some parts of the country.
It's changed a lot.
But they are able to say, well, that's okay. You're allowed to be critical of Israel. That's not necessarily anti-Semitism. But if you talk about the power of the Israel lobby or of AIPAC, which Fortune magazine puts usually in the top two most powerful lobbying organizations, so even though this is very factually accurate, as soon as someone starts talking about the power of the Israel lobby, of the special interest lobby, then supposedly that becomes anti-Semitic. Or if you question the whole system of Israel itself, in which one group is supreme and other groups are subsidiary, a system in which some people are discriminated against because of their religion or ethnicity, a principle I oppose no matter who does it, if you oppose that principle in the case of Israel, somehow that makes you anti-Semitic or a bigot. Whereas in reality, it is a universal principle that many of us believe in. So they keep defining statements that are either factual or, I feel, ethical. They try to define as bigotry or, and or, in other words, anti-Semitism.
That's true. Therefore, I like to, you know, I've told you this before, last time we spoke, but I'll share it with you again. I redefine things because I can, Allison. And I refer to AIPAC as American-Israeli parasites against the Constitution.
I haven't heard that one before, but that's got a certain ring to it.
That's got a great ring to it because I wrote it, and I'll send it to you. Of course, Iran stands for Israel Requires American Naivety.
Oh, that's interesting, too. That's right, because certainly AIPAC and others have their sights set on Iran to have us somehow do massive damage to that country, much the way we did to Iraq.
Don't say we, Allison. Say the federal government.
I agree. Thank you. I agree with that correction.
I'm not trying to correct you.
It's not even every government official, because a lot of governmental officials, as my article shows in the past, and it still continues today, do try to oppose these programs, but they continually get overruled by people who want to be reelected and therefore take the stands that AIPAC and the rest of the lobby want them to take.
And of course, you know, the Mossad has deeply infiltrated our government and our military, and they cooperate with the CIA and MI6. I believe that Mossad was behind 9/11, which led to the demonization of Muslims and Islam. You see that more power for Israel, more power for the military-industrial complex, and because Israel wants bigger borders, they want to expand. So I think it was a big thing that they staged to demonize Islam, and that's how I look at it. I refuse to be part of that game. Yes, there's radicals and terrorists who are Muslims, but again, why are they like that? And that's where I agree with Ron Paul. I mean, I take it further than him. I'm more strident, but it's because we've intervened over there, obviously. We're in over 900 military bases in over 140 countries and propping up Israel. That's why they're pissed off. And Palestinians would be just as angry if their land was invaded and taken by Chinese, Peruvians, or Martians. It's because of what happened to them by who did it. In this case, it happened to be Jews. And that's where this legacy comes from. So when America gets involved in it, thanks to Harry Truman largely, because the Zionists of the lobby gave him $2 million for his campaign in 48, he recognized the State of Israel against George Marshall and many of his staff and whatnot. And this legacy of helping them ever since then, contrary to Jefferson and Washington advising us about foreign entanglements, you can see where it's gotten us.
Yeah, it's a pretty dismal situation. It's extremely dangerous for everybody. It's creating this, quote, clash of civilizations instead of, as you said, you know, when you look, I remember talking to somebody recently, an intelligent person, But the man said, well, the problem is, you know, Arabs just never recognized Israel. And I said, well, you know, he happened to live in California on a beautiful ranch. And I said, well, how would you like it if somebody came and took away half of California or half of America? Would you recognize they had the right to take away half of the United States? He said, I'd be on my porch with my shotgun. You know, so it's sort of, once you recognize how we would, or many people would react if we were being forced out or if our land were being stolen, then you start saying, oh, yeah, they're reacting probably the way many Americans, no doubt the way many Americans would react. Our Revolutionary War was a violent war. It wasn't nonviolent. I'm not aware of any nonviolent actions against the British. When I think about it, I imagine there were, but certainly what we hear about are the battles of Concord and various places and carrying around the musket. So that's what you usually do when you're trying to fight for your freedom. And yet, through this, the media distortion, people can forget that and sort of think, oh, this is an alien reaction. It's the reaction of such a different religion. That's how, because they're so different than we are. And often, you know, there are differences. We all have differences. But often you find, well, actually, it's because we are so similar, and that's what we would do also.
Well, interesting you mentioned the British, because I, to this day, I am very pro-British, but I'm very anti-Churchill. And if you know what his role was in World War I and World War II, he had a lot to do with causing this mess from behind the scenes in World War I to directly in World War II. And he hastened the demise of the British Empire that he so sought to preserve. Because in World War I and World War II, Britain and France picked a fight with Germany that they could not win without U.S. support. And this brings us to the international bankers that Hitler railed against. And if you look at the bankers today, they're international Zionists. They're tied into the Rothschild Rockefeller wing, I believe. There are many families in Europe are owners of the Federal Reserve System. You know, Bernanke, Greenspan, you know, Zionists. So, you know, people can say what they want. If it quacks like a duck, it's pretty much a duck. And I don't back down from it. So that's where I'm coming from. So I'm glad to have you on tonight. I appreciate you coming on again, and it's always fun to talk to you. You've really done your homework, and that makes all the difference in the world because you can really hold your own. I haven't had the opportunity to really clash with anybody on this yet, but I'm looking forward to the day because I'm pretty much Teflon about it, and I think I'd like to have you in the audience to enjoy it when it ever goes down.
It would be good to have some real debates about this because we're just not, you know, as we mentioned earlier, most people aren't getting into these aspects, and we need to. We need to do it in a reasonable, informed way, but it needs to be discussed. And we need to all move beyond it. And we cannot move beyond it. We cannot find peace. We will not find security until we discuss more of this history and how it relates to what's going on today in a more honest, direct fashion. So I'm glad you're taking that on.
Thank you. Right you are. And the same to you. I appreciate what you're doing and where you're coming from. And I'm going to stay on this path. I just got an email from a friend of mine. And I know what this is called, if he's out there listening. It's called, do you know about the Samson option?
Yes, I do.
Well, let me tell you what my friend just wrote. Have you heard of the possibility that Israel has nukes pointed at all the countries of the Middle East and also many at all of Europe? If they go down, they will take Europe with them. Nice folks, right? Yes, that's exactly right. Martin van Creveld, a Dutch Jew who lives in Israel, had said this, that if they're in some kind of battle and they're losing, they intend to take everybody else with them. And look where Israel is situated. They can hit Europe, they can hit London, Italy, you know, Rome, they can hit Russia, they can hit China. And they got, 200 to 300 nukes. I'm much more worried about Israel than Iran. And have you, I'll tell you what's a good thing to look up, Allison, if you haven't already. Have you looked up Jews United Against Zionism? Do you know about them? There is some interesting stuff to read.
I'll look at that. Yeah, I will.
Because
I might have seen it. I sometimes read articles at various places, but I'll check that out.
Well, I'll send that to you, too. Because, Allison, okay. In my humble yet all-knowing opinion, the solution for the Middle East is for us to find immediate common ground with, first and foremost, I can't stress this enough, Jews united against Zionism. They may be small in number, but from what I've studied, what they say makes the most sense. Jews united against Zionism, followed by the Israeli peace movement and Israeli human rights groups. That's what we should look to. And also, I know I corrected you gently earlier, and I always tell people this. I told Ron Paul this recently. I got to speak to him briefly. It's always better when we're talking about what America's done to other countries in terms of war to try to make a conscious effort for us never to say we or America or the U.S. If we always can say the federal government, then it puts the blame squarely where it belongs. As in the federal government's drug war, Allison, look what it's done to Mexico. And I laugh when they say they just killed this kingpin or they've imprisoned this kingpin as if somebody else isn't going to take his place. That's just how it goes.
Yeah, I like that. I think that's important to always, not take on guilt that you don't have. We all probably have enough things that we might feel bad about. And the things that were done by the federal government should be clearly attributed there. I agree. This is not Americans doing these things. It's not the informed American public position. It's the federal taking actions that most of us would oppose if we actually knew what was going on.
That's true. Hence, if Americans knew, that is why, to a clear example of what I just said about delineating, the federal government from the people, is that if you look at the bumper stickers, "I love my country, but I fear my government," that's what I mean, the federal government. They're the main problem. They're the ones that create the inflation. They're the ones printing money out of thin air, creating wars. The states cannot station troops overseas. They can't declare war in other countries. They can't print money. So that's where this whole thing is going. I haven't asked you about Ron Paul. I hope you're a fan. I hope you support him. I hope you've checked him out, listened to him. He would cut off all foreign aid. He's been called anti-Semitic, as if cutting off Israel's aid is anti-Semitic, although there's prominent Jews who agree with him and whatnot. So he would cut off all foreign aid. And as I said at the beginning of the show, I would cut off all foreign aid to all countries, all tax-supported foreign aid. And therefore, if Allison or PK want to help somebody in another country or the cause of their choice, they're free to send a check. But they cannot be forced to give to other countries on the behest of somebody else who's deciding who needs help and who doesn't. In other words, there's no gun aimed at your wallet.
That's one thing I should mention, if it's not too late, is I'm also at another organization called the Council for the National Interest. I'm president of that, and the URL is councilforthenationalinterest.org. It has a lot of information there, too, so I hope people will look at it if they have the chance.
Well, thank you for that. I just wrote that down. So as I close and wind down now, Allison, I want to thank you so much again from coming on from If Americans Knew. And I applaud the work you're doing. We haven't met personally, but consider me a good friend of yours and a fan of yours. And your soft-spoken way is very unintimidating. You're not blunt like me, but I like being blunt and cutting to the chase because we're still going down the same path. And I'm a big advocate, a staunch advocate of liberty, property, and peace. So I'm going to say thank you again and goodbye for now. And this is your host, PK. Signing off until next week. And I'm here every Monday evening at bbsradio.com at 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, and 11:55 Eastern. This is your not so humble host, PK, saying good night, and I'll talk to you next week.